Hi, writers. I'm glad we are together again for an episode on the craft of writing fiction. This is Jim Thayer. We writers are all cowboys and cowgirls at the old writing corral, and I'm glad of it, so let's get going. I want to return to one of the most important techniques we ever talk about because I was asked about it by one of our listeners. It's a critical skill, and doing it right is important for us writers because doing it wrongly likely sinks our story's prospects. I call it BC plotting. I don't know what other writers call it, but the good writers all know it and do it. As you've heard me say, a difference exists between a chronology and a scene. A chronology is outlined this way: A, B, C, D, where A is the setup, B and C are the heart of the scene, and D is the wind down. A successful scene should be outlined this way: B, C. So if we are writing chronologies, which is a mistake, our PowerPoint outline is A, B, C, D, then our new scene is A, B, C, D, our new scene yet again is A, B, C, D, and so on. If we are writing scenes, our outline is B, C, new scene, B, C, new scene, B, C. Novelist David Morrell puts it this way: if your scene is represented by A, B, C, and D, A and D are implied, while only B and C are dramatized in the scene. Here's a bald example of ABC plotting. It's our outline of the scene, and it's laughable, but I hope to make a point. A. Marianne wakes up, puts on clothes, makes and eats breakfast, and drives to the doctor's office. B. Carrying a sheet of documents and an iPad, the doctor enters the exam room. C. The doctor tells Marianne that the biopsy was negative. She is cancer-free. D. Marianne leaves the clinic and drives to the elementary school to pick up her daughter Elizabeth, then drives home. Yeah, who would make this mistake? It's laughable, but it's laughable to us because we know the technique. We know to avoid A and D, the setup and the wind down of a chronology. When I was editing and teaching, I'd see this A, B, C, D scene plotting mistake all the time. The desire to set up a scene, to write the A portion, is almost irresistible for many new writers. They can't get the scene going without first setting it up. And then they can't end the scene without winding it down. That's how our real lives work, with setups and wind downs, but it's not how good fiction works. The outline, the bullet point presentation, of our scene should be B, C. And the next scene should be B, C. And same with the next scene. How deeply seated is the desire to set up things and wind down things? I once edited a novel by a writer who was skilled in a lot of ways. His character descriptions were first rate, and his dialogue was terrific. It was a pleasure to read. But he simply could not begin a scene without setting it up, particularly getting the character to the location of the scene. He documented driving to the location in every scene. The reader began each scene in a car, and twice in an airplane, always following the character to the location of the heart of the scene. The writer didn't know that fiction is magic. We can just put our character there, in the gunfight, in the hospital surgery, in the middle of the riot, at the bank just before the robbery, at the romantic meeting in the park. We don't need to document the character's drive to that place. It's the A. If we are writing our scene, a red flag should go up if we begin our scene with driving, with getting dressed, with heaven forfend getting out of bed, with making breakfast or shaving, with driving Johnny to school, with all of those things we do in our real lives to begin the day. A red flag should go up if we've begun our chapter with them, because we've begun the chapter at A. And similarly, a red flag should go up if we find ourselves ending a scene with driving back somewhere, or with saying goodnight, or turning out the light, or taking off clothes, or feeding the dog his supper, or most of the things we do in our real lives to end the day. The reader infers that our characters do normal things. We don't need to write about them. We can end our chapter at C, not D. So instead of A, B, C, D, our scene outline should be B, C, and our scenes should jump from B, C to B, C to B, C. I want to mention a failed experiment. I look back now and smile. I learned something from it, and maybe it can serve as a lesson for some of us writers. Agatha Christie's grandson, Matthew Pritchard, said that Agatha Christie used to dictate her stories into a machine called a dictaphone, and then a secretary typed this up into a typescript, which his grandmother would correct by hand. Dan Brown, the author of The Da Vinci Code, reportedly dictates his early drafts of novels. Well, if they could do it, maybe I could do it. I'm a slow writer. Maybe I could be faster. So I decided to experiment. Could I dictate a novel and do it quickly? Maybe I could be a faster writer by dictating. A couple of years ago, I set up the experiment. My goal was I would dictate a chapter a day, taking 1 hour each day. At the end of 14 one-hour sessions, I would have 14 chapters and my novel would be done. I like westerns, so I set the novel in Leadville, Colorado in 1882. Each day I sat there dictating with a machine in my hand, and I felt quite important, quite au courant, quite Agatha Christie-like, fabulous. In terms of getting the words into the dictating machine and keeping to my schedule, the experiment was a success. Then I transcribed the novel. I printed it out. It looked like a novel, 250 pages, quality paper, 24-pound bright white. It was stacked neatly on my desk. But in terms of producing a readable novel, the experiment was a failure. It was more than a failure. It was unreadable dreck. As sawdust is to a tree, my novel was to literature. As a limerick is to Shakespeare, my novel was to literature. The human brain has 170 billion cells. I must have used, 450 cells creating this so-called novel. The plot was hackneyed. The characters were stereotypes. The dialogue was straight from a high school play. Of tense pacing, there was none. Of unexpected plot points, there were none. Of shining, masterful, lovely sentence, there were, let me count them and round off the number. There were none. I didn't do too badly describing Leadville and the characters' clothing and the horses, but Leadville, clothing, and horses do not make a novel. I was disappointed in the outcome of my dictating experiment, but I knew going in that it was an experiment, and some experiments fail. Failures are integral to the scientific process and perhaps to the writing process. And this dictating a Western was integral to my discovery of my own writing method. I'm a slow writer. And the reason I'm a slow writer is that I need slowness. I've settled for slowness now. That's how I write, and I'm not going to look for a faster way. Not now. You might be the same way. The Washington Post used to have a feature called the Style Invitational, where readers were asked to come up with lame analogies. Here are some wonderfully lame analogies invented by Posts, or the Washington Post's readers. He fell for her like his heart was a mob informant and she was the East River. Shots rang out, as shots are wont to do. Here's one of my favorites. The plan was simple, like my brother-in-law Phil. But unlike Phil, this plan might just work. The younger fighter had a hungry look, the kind you get from not eating for a while. He was as lame as a duck. Not the metaphorical lame duck, either, but a real duck that was actually lame, maybe from stepping on a landmine or something. Her artistic sense was exquisitely refined, like someone who can tell butter from, "I can't believe it's not butter." It came down the stairs looking very much like something no one has ever seen before. The dandelion swayed in the gentle breeze, like an oscillating electric fan set on medium. The lamp just sat there, like an inanimate object. She was as easy as the TV guide crossword. Her eyes were like limpid pools, only they had forgotten to put in any pH cleanser. Her pants fit her like a glove. Well, maybe more like a mitten, actually. She walked into my office like a centipede with 98 missing legs. Her face was a perfect oval, like a circle that had its two other sides gently compressed by a thigh master. That's from the Washington Post. Aren't those wonderful? Please allow me a moment of self-promotion. Creative Texts, the publisher, has just published my latest novel titled Fagin and Miss Havisham. Here's the pitch for it. London, 1820s. It's 10 years before the time of Charles Dickens's novel, and the wild Miss Havisham is bent on revenge against the swindler who left her at the altar on her wedding day in Great Expectations. But it won't be as simple as she hopes. Miss Havisham will be aided, or sabotaged, by the pickpocket Fagin and the brawler Bill Sykes from Oliver Twist, and the fearsome lawyer Jaggers and the burly convict Magwitch from Great Expectations, the kindly theater manager Vincent Crummles from Nicholas Nickleby, the wicked Murdstone from David Copperfield, and the street-smart Inspector Bucket from Bleak House. Shifty Uriah Heep and bumbling Wilkins Micawber from David Copperfield and the wretched Arthur Gride from Nicholas Nickleby will also be there. These famous Dickens characters from his many novels are young, strong, and shrewd, and Fagin and Miss Havisham throws them together like dice tossed in a cup. Miss Havisham will have her revenge, or maybe not. That's the pitch for my new novel, Fagin and Miss Havisham. I hope you'll consider getting a copy. It's at Amazon in print and email versions or e-book versions, and soon it'll be in an Audible version, which I'm really looking forward to. You kindly listen to me talk about good writing techniques. You'll be able to see if I can actually do the techniques I recommend. And thank you. Our listener Jamila asked, "Please, could you talk about this topic? I have found myself rewriting perfectly good sentences to avoid was. Sometimes it makes a difference to the energy of the sentence. Other times it just creates work and detracts from the flow of the writing." Jamila is asking about using was and were. Sometimes we focus on creating strong sentences. Put 7,000 strong sentences together and we'll likely have a strong novel. Here is a terrific technique for strong sentences. Question. We writers should question the use of the words was and were as verbs. Was and were are not as dynamic as verbs such as run, fly, fight, kiss, jump, hug. There are thousands of action verbs in the language. So there's a difference between these two sentences. Here is the use of was. The moon was rising in the east. Here is the same sentence using the verb rose and not using was. The moon rose in the east. Hear the difference? Was rising as opposed to rose. Here's another, the first was version. The cat was standing on the sofa. Here's the more active version. The cat stood on the sofa. The problem with was and were is that they typically denote a state of being or existence rather than action. These verbs are forms of the verb phrase to be. Often they are needed to set out certain things. Was and were can make sentences feel inert and passive, though. Was and were often are less direct than an action verb. She was jumping is less direct and less forceful than she jumped. And another thing, the use of was and were is often a telltale that the sentence is in the passive rather than the active form. The cookies were baked by my sister is the passive voice. My sister baked the cookies is the active voice, using the strong word baked. Action verbs such as run, fly, fight, kiss, and thousands of others create a feeling of action and movement. They're more dynamic and energetic than was and were. Here's a couple examples. His cell phone rang is active. His cell phone was ringing, not so much. She danced is more energetic than she was dancing. She played on the monkey bars is more active than she was playing on the monkey bars. An invasion force gathered at the border is more active than an invasion force was gathering. Birds flew overhead is more active than birds were flying overhead. Joni ate her food, as opposed to Joni was eating her food. He spoke to the doctor is active. He was speaking with the doctor, not so much. Fur covered his arm is active. Fur was covering his arm, not so much. Hear the difference? It's slight, but it's noticeable, especially if we put the was and were form in sentence after sentence. Here's a paragraph where every sentence is in the was and were form. The barber was clipping Denny's hair. Alan was sweeping the floor while Stan was squirting Windex on the mirror above the sink. Ben and an old man the barber didn't recognize were chatting near the front window. Aileen was rubbing conditioner onto a customer's scalp. Hear all the uses of was and were. They give the paragraph a monotonous cadence, which the reader might not know the cause of, but might feel. Was and were here indicate a state of being rather than directly mean an action. The action feels muted, and it not happening right in front of the reader. Here's a better version of the same couple of sentences. The barber clipped Denny's hair. Alan swept the floor while Stan squirted Windex on the mirror above the sink. Ben and an old man the barber didn't recognize chatted near the front window. Aileen rubbed a conditioner onto a customer's scalp. This paragraph is more forceful and more immediate. Instead of states of being with was and were as verbs, the scene is moving. Action is right there in front of the reader. These differences between the active verbs such as run and dive and the was and were forms might seem slight when viewed one at a time, but the chronic use of was and were makes sentences and paragraphs and pages seem leaden. It makes them feel sleepy. So the technique is an easy one and a good one. When we find ourselves writing was and were, ask ourselves, can I make this sentence more active? I've written, the dog was swimming in the pond. Well, there's a was swimming. I'll change it to the dog swam in the pond. It's more active. It's a more vibrant sentence. This is one of those money writing techniques. Not all uses of was and were can or should be eliminated, but we should question the use of each one of them and replace them with more active verb forms if we can. I've asked our listeners to send me an example of how writing might have been important to you. Here is from our listener, Carl. This is Carl. Last year, my then 12-year-old son was bullied in school. That made him very unhappy in many ways. When his best friends took sides with the bullies, it broke his heart. This school year, he moved to high school in the big city, like all other kids. Somehow everything is different this year, and the problem didn't continue. My son was always a big fan of Lord of the Rings and several other epic fantasy stories. He loved to play D&D and to make his own stories. He sees me writing my books, and I often ask him for help and inspiration. Then he announced that he wants to write a book of his own. I propose to help him with my newfound skills. The result is that we are creating an epic medieval fantasy story with many scary creatures and heroes to fight each other that exactly reflects and echoes my son's battle for survival and power and victory over the bullies from school last year. Each bully was with his or her strengths and weaknesses, and the treacherous friends play their roles in an often nightmare-like universe. Above these creatures live the gods who apply their invisible influence over the scenes. In the real world, these gods were the parents, teachers, and school psychologists, and so on. Apart from the therapeutic value and the great literary importance of our work, it is so much fun to do this with my son. As Shakespeare and Elvis have already said, the world is a stage and each must play its part. And play we do. Isn't that a nice glimpse from Carl and his son of what fiction can sometimes do for us and for our readers? We writers write, and who knows what good things may come of it. I like reading how successful writers work. Maybe some of it can rub off on me. P.G. Wodehouse wrote more than 90 books and 20 film scripts. He lived from 1881 to 1975, and he's one of the most widely read funny writers of the 20th century. He worked even into the last decade of his life. The New Yorker's Herbert Warren Wind visited Wodehouse and noted that Woodhouse's two outstanding traits were his industry and his basic cheerfulness. Wodehouse said, "I seem to be rather good at adjusting to things." Mason Curry, in his terrific book, Daily Rituals, says the author rose each day at 7:30 sharp and stepped out onto the back porch for the Daily Dozen series of calisthenic exercises, which he had performed every day since they were introduced into the United States in 1919. Then, with his wife still asleep upstairs, Wodehouse fixed himself toast, coffee, cake, and tea, and as he ate, read what he called a breakfast book, a mystery novel by someone like Nagao Marsh or Rex Stout, or a light humorous book. Afterward, he smoked a pipe, took a short walk with the dogs, and by 9 o'clock settled down to work. The magazine writer Wind wrote, quote, "Wodehouse does his writing in his study, a fairly large, pine-walled room on the ground floor overlooking the back garden. The principal pieces of furniture are a leather armchair for lounging and thinking, and a plain wooden desk about 3 feet by 5. On top of the desk are a dictionary, a knife for cleaning out pipes, and a bulky Royal typewriter, which Wodehouse has used since 1934. His method of composition has remained virtually unchanged through the years. He does the first draft in longhand, in pencil. Then he sits down at the Royal and revises and polishes as he types. At present, his average output on a good working day is about 1,000 words, but when he was younger, it was closer to 2,500. Once, when he was beginning a Wooster Jeeves novel, that's his famous character, he experimented with using a dictaphone. After he had dictated the equivalent of a page, he played it back to check it over. What he heard sounded so terribly unfunny that he immediately turned off the machine and went back to his pad and pencil. Lunch at home was followed at about 2 o'clock with another walk. Woodhouse's neighbor and longtime friend Guy Bolton would pick him up, and they would take an hour's constitutional with the dogs in tow. Woodhouse had to be back in his study by 3:30 for the soap opera The Edge of Night, which he never missed. Then he had a traditional English tea with his wife. After this, according to the biographer Robert McCrum, he might snooze a bit in his armchair, have a bath, and do some more work before the evening cocktail, sherry for her, a lethal martini for him, at 6, which they took in the sun parlor overlooking the garden. This was followed by dinner alone with Ethel and eaten early to allow the cook to get home to her family. After dinner, Woodhouse would usually read, but occasionally he would play two-handed bridge with Ethel, a habit, he joked, that doubtlessly suggested he was senile. This has been from Mason Curry's book on how called Daily Rituals on How P.G. Woodhouse Worked. I get the impression that P.G. Woodhouse would have been fun to know. Isn't that a nice feeling when you read about someone from history and you get the feeling, I'd like to have dinner with him or her? We've arrived at the end of this session. I'll see you next time, and I'm already looking forward to it. This is Jim Thayer, and I hope you will keep tapping those keys.